want to say hello on a beautiful Thursday. Good morning, good afternoon. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in all over the world. And I mean that sincerely. Today we have another great show. Another former Georgetown Hoya. Today our guest will be Mr. Jerome Junkyard Dog Williams. And I'm really excited about that, Ricky. So I'm ready to go. If Jerome's on the line, we can get it started.
I'm checking for him now, Derek. Check your text. I got a text in to you. And I think I got his number. We got a lot of calls in, so I'm trying to pick out his number.
Call California.
What's that area code?
Let me check, because he did not try to reach him. I haven't heard back from him today. California is 213, I believe.
No, he hadn't checked in yet. But until he gets here, I got to ask you about this list ESPN has out. And I'm surprised where your big brother George, the great Iceman Gervin, landed at 47. And, you know, I'm not taking anything away from – there have been so many fantastic players to come through the NBA. But George is just too far down that list in my estimation at 47, considering that, you know, he was one of the guys that helped bring the flair to the game in the early 70s when George came over from the ABA. Of course, Doc, you know, they were playing with the red and white ball, flashy, prolific scores. Those are the guys that helped change this game. And taking nothing away from other guys because there's been so many. But just your thoughts on George's status in that list.
Wow. The list to me, it just shows how times have changed, Ricky. I've watched a lot of basketball in my life. I'm 57, so I've been watching this game about 50 years. And it breaks my heart, man. Not even to see George rated so low, but just the disrespect. You have Rick Barry rated number 43, which I thought was a joke. You have Rick Barry rated number 43, but you have Giannis rated number 27. And Giannis is still playing, and it's just a different era. I don't know who's doing these rankings, but
You know what I think it is there? We see Giannis today. And just like Bob McAdoo mentioned the other day when we had him on the show, people forget about you.
Yeah, I can kind of understand that, Ricky. But, I mean, the game has changed. It used to be you wait until a guy – the reason I say disrespectful, how can you rate a guy that's still playing over guys that have put in a complete body of work? I'm just sitting here looking at Giannis. I'm looking at you can bring up George. George has won 4 scoring titles, whether he won a championship or not. He was one of the elite players in his era. If I remember correctly, during his era, at one time, it was just George and Magic Johnson as the two best players in the backcourt. And when you're up there with Magic Johnson, that's a very high level to attain. And then you have guys that are still playing that hasn't won a championship. I know Giannis, he won 1 MVP last year. But Milwaukee has really not done anything. They lost to Toronto last year after blowing a 2-0 lead. And, you know, I think Giannis is a great player. But you have to go back to respect. Let these guys finish their careers first. I saw Oscar Robertson wasn't on the top 10 list. How can you have a top 10 list with Oscar Robertson? So it's just a different time today. I don't necessarily agree with it, but there's nothing I can do about it. So we just roll with the punches, I guess.
And you know what? It's just an opinion. Everybody got an opinion. And there are, you know, just dozens of great players that have come through the league. And just to be on that list, just think about it. You're talking about thousands of guys that have played in the National Basketball Association. So just to be on that list is an honor. But I am so with you. You know, a guy like Giannis, who obviously is a terrific player, to push him ahead of so many guys who put in the work just doesn't make sense. But he's the guy that we're seeing now.
Well, the NBA is still thriving. Still exciting game for the fans. If you look at it today, though, it's more of a young person's game. And it's kind of sad because a lot of the older players are being phased out. I look at guys like Wilt. We talk about these greatest players. And I think there have been some great players out there. Even when you look at the college game, this is what really saddened me. I'm big on the college game, all right? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And I'm just trying to figure it out. You got a guy that was played 3 years in college. He was a three-time player of the year. And he was three-time MVP of the finals, of the championship. But you have guys that Michael Jordan was rated over him with one championship. I thought Mike was a very good player in North Carolina. He hadn't developed into a great player yet. You got guys like Christian Laettner, who I thought should have ranked a lot higher. But anytime you look at it, talking about guys being ranked in over Wilt Chamberlain and Kareem Abdul, Lou Alcindor, I'll say, and guys that played back then, I mean, it's just, to me, it's disrespectful. I don't know how we fix it. Do you add a new list? Do you start a new top 50 list for the NBA? I don't know how you rectify it. What do you think, Ricky?
No, it just is what it is. That's their list. The guys who picked that list out. Somebody may come out with a list that's entirely different. So, no big deal. Because it's an ESPN list, it doesn't make it any more important than any other list. It's just, more people who read it. I mean, I always talk about you. You're one of the most knowledgeable basketball minds that I know, and you come from a great basketball family. I'm going to listen to you talk about basketball before I listen to a guy like Stephen A. No disrespect to Stephen A., but he doesn't have the experiences you have of playing in the National Basketball Association, playing overseas, being in the same family as your big brother George, playing with and against him. I mean, so your insights and your experiences carry a little more weight to me. So these lists that come out, that's just what they are, a list. If Derek Irvin puts out a list, I'm going to give it more weight than some of the other lists I might see.
Well, thank you for that. You might some of the Facebookers might disagree, but that's fine as well. That's okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Ricky,
who's on that list is not a great player? I mean, everybody has their moments.
Well, I had some people was questioning me yesterday about Scottie Pippen. Is he a top 50 player? And for me, that was like ludicrous. I don't see how he could not be a top 50 player. The man he made all defensive first team 8 times. And he made second team all defense 2 times. That's ten all defensive team. Just that alone, on those merits alone, that makes you a top 50 player. But sometimes I guess people have certain things that they like. A lot of people like, I guess, substance. They want to see fancy stuff. And
yeah.
I'm not worried about fancy. I'm more worried about production. You look at the game today, and it saddens me even more. You see guys that do crossover moves, and they trick a guy, and the guy falls all back on the floor and all that. And the crowd, you got the kids running around the gym celebrating, and then he misses the shot. So,
they don't care about that, man. He did the move,
I like Ja Morant. They showed him this year 2 or 3 dunk attempts. He didn't make them, but they were showing them like they were the player of the year, top 10 or something. He didn't complete not one of the dunks. But they were giving him credit, like they're going to make him all of a sudden. Now he moves over Vince Carter as the best dunker of all time, even though he's missing the dunks. So it's just things that we deal with today.
You getting credits for dunks that you missed now? Come on, man.
Well, they do. I can prove it. They started with Nate Robinson. Little Nate won a couple dunk contests. One he earned. The other one they gave it to him. I remember clearly Isaiah Thomas was on the television as one of the hosts, one of the announcers. Nate Robinson had to miss the same dunks, and I'm no exaggeration, about 18, 19 times. And then when he finally made the one, they rewarded him with a 10, I believe, even though he missed 19 times. That tells me my math, if you 19, you missed 19 out of 10, that means you only made 5%.
Man, let me tell you, I wish I could do that on the golf course, brother. I'd be on the senior tour right now. Shoot, you going to give me that many chances to make a call? I'm going to make it. But you know what? You mentioned Scotty a minute ago. And when the Knicks, that Knicks series, where Charles Smith was under the basket, I just happened to see that watching the documentary last week. And I forgot what a great defensive stand that was. Because even watching it, you know the scene I'm talking about? Charles Smith gets the ball.
No, I
know
exactly. Michael was under the basket. Horace Grant, I remember too.
Yeah. I mean, they just went after him, and Scotty was so long. But the funny thing about that there, even watching that the other night, I still thought, well, maybe he might make it. Because he went up like 4 or 5 times. He just couldn't get that ball in the basket.
And I felt so bad because I like Charles a lot. I've talked to Charles. I even talked to him when he was here when they did roast for George here in San Antonio. And Rick Barry and all the guys were here and Bill Russell and Oscar. And it was funny. Charles was there as well. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize all the good things Charles has done. He's kind of got a bad rap for getting his shots blocked by the NBA champion Bulls.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he played against a tough team, and you see they had built a wall around him. He had shot fakes about 3, 4, 5 times, but they played team defense. And it was a crucial moment in the game, and it just showed what happens when guys – bind together. There's power in numbers. And those guys, they just had a no-lose attitude. And you can see it in that place. And we all know what happened after that. We started looking at a new Chicago Bulls team.
Yeah, and you're right. That play, you talk to 100 NBA basketball fans, and you mentioned Charles Smith. That play is probably what they're going to bring out. I'm sure 90 of them are going to bring up that play. And he did a lot of good things on the basketball floor and had a very good career.
Ricky, I'm going to first I want to update the people. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to Derek Gervin's As Good As It Gets podcast. Ricky Hampton Sr., my partner, I love doing the show with Ricky. We've been making strides, and I've been very happy. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We have a great guest that's on the line that's waiting on us. And I want to welcome him in now. Mr. Jerome Williams. How you doing, Jerome?
Let's see. Hold on.
He's on.
Hey, Jerome,
how
you
doing? Oh, man.
We in the
junkyard dog is in the house, fellas.
That's it. Come on,
how you
Ricky.
Doing,
come on, Derek. What's happening? I'm doing good, man.
You
doing good.
My man.
Out here in Las Vegas, holding
it down. You are, sir. I want to thank you for tuning in, and I'm going to tell you why. 11 days ago, I had another big show. I had Michael Graham on the show. And
yes, sir.
I know you guys are familiar with Mike, and you guys are from the same area. A lot of people don't know. When I was playing, I played in the early 80s. But as I've always been a basketball fan. I became a very big fan of the Georgetown Hoyas, a very big fan of John Thompson, and a very big fan of yours. And I mean that sincerely. The flair that you brought to the game is kind of like what we're missing today. And I appreciate you, and I just want to thank you for coming on.
Hey, man, I appreciate you having me on, man. You know, that love of the game, I had to pay homage to my dad because he used to work, you know, 60, 70-hour work weeks, and from there would come home and make sure he gave myself and my older brother Johnny time on the basketball court, just playing and bonding. So that's where I developed that love of the game. So I want to give a shout-out to my dad, Johnny Williams, Jr.
Yes, good. Jerome, you played in Magruder High School in Rockville, Maryland, I understand. At what point did you become interested in pursuing college basketball or pursuing the NBA possibly?
Oh, man, it was long before that. I mean, when I was 6 years old, I woke up Christmas morning, and I go downstairs, and the first thing I see in the kitchen amongst all the toys is a Dr. J. Julius Erving plastic basketball hoop with ball. And my brother and I, we didn't see anything else. And there was a lot of other toys there. But from that day, it was one-on-one. It was going at each other. It was dunking on each other. And that was where I wanted to play basketball for the rest of my life. I was just like, nah, this is it. This is it for me. So during that time, I had my dad, the company that he worked for, Wilco Construction, he was an electrical engineer. So the owner of the construction company bought season tickets to the Capitals, you know, the hockey team, NHL, Washington Capitals. And when he bought those season tickets, he was given four other tickets to the Bullets games, so the Washington Bullets. So he wasn't a basketball fan. So because he liked my dad, he gave my dad those four tickets. So I got the chance to see Dr. J, Iceman, Magic Johnson in person, in live, living color. I could see the sweat. And when you see the sweat as a youngster, man, you're hooked. You're just like, man, if I could ever do that. So not only was I watching the stars of the game, I was also watching the players on the bench, players that didn't play as much, and I wanted to see where their skill sets were and why they weren't as good as some of the players that were on the court. So that's basically where I got my drive, and that's where I decided I was at 6 years old, didn't come in high school.
Now, I got to tell you this, then I'm going to let Ricky chime in. This, I'm going to show you how life is funny. I'm looking at one of my friends right now, Michael Jordan, right next to him, Benny White. It's funny because at 6 years old, Jerome, I'm a little older than you. I'm 57. But I have to tell you, Jerome, I was about 9 years old, I believe, when George went to the ABA. He's 11 years older than me, so maybe I was eight. The first person I met was Dr. J, Julius Erving. And I was inspired immediately, and I know he had to somehow inspire you. Have you ever had an opportunity to sit down and talk with Dr. J?
Man, I do you one even better. So after high school, my career in basketball was mostly played on the playground. I was attending a junior college. I went out and got a job to continue my education. I was working at a gas station. So during spring break, my friends and I decided we were going to drive down to Daytona Beach for spring break. So we get down to Daytona, and we say, hey, let's go ahead and take a walk on the beach. Okay, so we start walking. It was me and two of my friends. And one of them was my best friend, who's ultimate hooper like me. So in the distance, we can see like a large group of like spring breakers, like, you know, at least 3,000 to 5,000. So we knew there was something going on. We're like, man, I wonder what's going on up there. So as we got closer, over the crowd, we just see a basketball, like, just sort of going up in the air, and we could see a hoop. They're like, man, they playing basketball over there? So now we're getting kind of excited. Anyway, we clamber our way through the crowd, get near the front, not all the way in the front, but we could at least see better. And we see it's Dr. J out there giving a like basically a promotion through Coca-Cola. So he was demonstrating and doing something. We like, man, Dr. J out there. So we just, you know, obviously we all tuned in. So he's giving a demonstration, and right in the demonstration, he says, "Well, before I head on out of here, I want to play somebody one on one. I'm just gonna pick them out the crowd. Who wants to play?" Man, so thousands of hands go shooting up, right? And I'm like 6'9", and I'm like waving in the back, and I'm jumping up and down. And he goes, "The guy in that yellow shirt, that dude, come up here. I want to play you one on one." And it was me. Man, like all my friends, we all come up to the front, right? So Doc is like, "What's your name?" I was like, "Jerome Williams." He's like, "All right." He's like, "So you think you can take on the Doc, huh?" I said, "Hey, man, listen, no time but the present." Doc's like, "All right, we're gonna play the five." You know, he said, "You get the ball first." I'm like, "Oh, shouldn't have did that." Now, I'm fresh out the gate. I'm just like, I just got out of the car. You know, I done took my first few, you know, walks on the sand playing Dr. J. Now, underneath my yellow shirt, I had a Charles Barkley jersey on, right? So the first three possessions, I had the ball. So I'm like, "All right, so I got to make five buckets." I said, "Okay, I know what I'm going to do. Bucket one, bucket two, bucket three." So bucket one, you know, I figure I better go inside and get a layup. So, you know what I mean? I do a move on Doc. You know, he's playing like token defense. And I go by him. You know, I score. Right? Now I'm testing the rim. I'm like, okay, this round. All right, my legs is pretty good. I can dunk. I was like, all right. So next shot, checks ball. I give him a jimmy. Boom, top of the key. Knocked down. Bow, 2-0. Right? Crowd's like, whoa, like, you know, starting to like, well, this kid got a little something. He didn't hit two shots in a row. So the next shot I do, I'm like, all right, I'm going to one of my go-tos. I'm going to cross him up. But this time I'm going to take off. I'm jumping. So cross up Doc, go in, take off, boom, right? Crowd's like, whoa, hold up, this kid. Hold up, right? So then Doc, he stops it and grabs the mic. He's like, "Okay, hold on, young fella. I see you got some skill." He's like, "All right, now we playing for real." Doc gets loose. He gets into a defensive stance. Now he lower than he was a couple of minutes ago. I'm like, whoa, okay. He's hitting me. Like, he's giving me that elbow, like, giving me the nudge. Like, okay, now you're getting ready to meet some force. So I'm like, but I'm up 3-0, so my confidence is high, right? I was like, all right, so I gave Doc that move last time, that crossover. This time I'm going to go opposite to fool him, thinking he's going to do this same thing. So I hit him with the move, and I go by him, but this time Doc is still with me. He's not like, you know, like not with me now, right? So I'm like, nah, this time he jumped with me, so I'm really jumping, right? Man, I jump to take off, man. I find myself in the stand. I was like, oh. And Doc says, "Nice try, young fella. Yep, come on back up to the top." So now it's his ball, right? So now Doc starts to get loose. Now he already been out there warming up, so he ain't need no extra, no warm up. So he hits a jimmy on me. Comes back, hits a layup, finger roll on me, then comes back, hits a mid-range. So now the score is tied 3-3. I'm like, oh, shoot, lost my lead. So I'm D-ing him up, and I end up getting a block on him, right? So I get the ball back. Now I'm like, all right, all right, I got him. I went to the basket a couple times. I definitely got to get one of these jumpers to go in again. So I give him a quick crossover and pull up. 4-3 now. I'm up. So Doc is giving, you know, check ball. I still got the ball. He slaps the ball out of my hand, takes the ball back from me. He comes back and scores. Now it's 4-tight. Now the crowd is into it. Everybody's like jumping them. They like, man, this is a real game. Tied up 4-4. My ball, right? I go to cross up Doc. Doc gets a steal, gets the ball back at the top of the key. He stops again and gives me a check ball to get his bearing. I know, see, this is a vet move right here. He was catching his breath. I didn't know that then, but I know it now. Doc was catching his breath, getting his system together, because he knew what he was going to do. I myself was like, shoot, you know, I got this. I just got to get the ball back, a good defensive stop. I'm concentrating on his dribble. I noticed his dribble's kind of high. So I'm like, you know, Doc wasn't really like the, you know, the crossover. You know, this is the new era coming in. We was more about the crossovers and all that. But Doc was old school. So I just had to time it. So Doc got the ball, checks it up. He's ready to go. And I know he's not going to pull up because I'm all the way up on him. I'm not giving him no space. If he pulls up, I'm going to give him a little nudge, you know, so he's going to be a little off balance. So Doc starts one direction, and basically, you know, the old school crossover kind of brings the ball across his body with his arm. I reach for the ball. Okay, but here's where I learned that Doc got some really big hands. This is where Doc proceeds to grab my hand as I'm reaching with the opposite hand that he has the ball in, right? So the hand that's free. He grabs my hand. And when he grabbed it, he says to me, get ready to take flight, young fella. And I'm like, take flight? Man, you at the 3-point line. What you talking about, take flight? In my head, I'm saying this to myself. I ain't say this out loud. I'm not talking trash to Doc. I'm just giving you my thoughts, people. So everybody listening on the line worldwide, know that there was no disrespect from the Dog Pound on my end at any point in this game. So Doc says, get ready to take flight, young fella. And I'm like, oh, what does that mean? He then picks up the ball, but again, he didn't have to bring the other hand to pick it up. He just palmed it. Similar to that shot he made against Kareem when the Philadelphia 76ers picked it up and cradled it. Yeah. That's it. But he didn't go underneath. He just picked it up, took his two steps while holding my hand the whole time, and took off and dunked it. The crowd went crazy. Right? Game was over. My dream was shot. I thought I was going to beat Doc. The dream was shot. Right?
Did you ever get to relay that story back to him, Jerome?
Come on, man. Me and Doc, good friends, man. We talked last week. We've been on NBA appearances together. We done told this story, man. And it's good when we tag team, because then you get the real full effect, because then you can hear Doc saying what he was thinking, then I'm telling you what I'm thinking, and it was, you know, it's made for TV. But I'm giving it to the viewers, because the listeners, because this is your show, and they, you know, most people haven't heard the story. So afterwards, this is the kicker, though. This is where it gets really good. Doc didn't let me leave, man. He said, hold on, before you go, I got some things I want to give you. So he takes out a brand new Spalding NBA ball, signs it. I'm sitting here in my office looking at it right now. Dr. J, Jerome says, stay strong on there, right?
Wow.
Then proceeds to give me that ball, takes pictures with my friends, and then he tells me, he says, well, tell me about yourself. You know, are you playing? What college are you going to? And I said, well, right now I'm not really playing for school. I'm in college. You know, hopefully get a scholarship. He said, wait a minute. He said, let me just tell you something. He said, you're going to make the NBA. And I was like, what? He said, yep. He said, man, your fire, your strength, your athleticism. He said, you got what it takes. So don't let nobody else tell you anything different.
Wow.
And, man, from that moment, from him telling me that, through the roof. I said, Dr. J, my lifelong idol, just told me I was going to make the NBA. 3 months later, John Thompson watches me play on the playground and offers me a full scholarship to Georgetown.
Wow.
I signed with Georgetown University, and the second person that he signs is Allen Iverson. The rest is history, gentlemen.
That's an amazing story.
So you talk about Dr. J, man. That's a friend of mine, man. That's a long term friend. And every time I've seen him since that day, we've given each other the biggest hug. And how's the family? We've done business together. He's a great human being. We go to church together. Chapel service, this dude right here, he is nothing but the truth, and I'm so glad that he was a part of my story, because he didn't have to do any of that, right? You know, he could have, you know, that could have went a whole lot of different ways, but he didn't shun my contact.
I mean, he's a friend of this show. We've had him on. And it's so funny, Jerome. I was a sports writer 35 years. I actually covered you some during your Pistons days when you were in Detroit. But Dr. J was the first guy I ever interviewed. And, you know, I was just so freaking excited that I forgot all my journalistic stuff. I'm like, I got to get an autograph from this dude. But then I came back, you just can't do that. Long story short, man, he ended up talking to me, encouraging me to pursue my profession. And fortunately, I got a chance to thank him on this show one day, the day he was on, man. But he was terrific, and I know Derek can say the same things about him.
Yep. Jerome,
I want to tell you why your story is so great, because I didn't even know you had a relationship with Doc. And so, you know, on my end, I was drafted by Philadelphia. I met Doc in 1972, I believe. But in 85, when I came out of college, I was drafted by Philly. And I believe a lot of that had to do with Doc. I was actually brought in to be his backup, to be his replacement. And I wasn't in the condition I should have been in, young knucklehead. But I've dealt with his family, dealt with his nephew. I think he's a great guy. And when someone like that tells you that you're going to make it, I mean, the sky's the limit.
Right. Sky's the limit. You know, it was just a special moment because, you know, as many of you know, when you play in the neighborhoods and you play in high school and different places and, you know, you're kind of lengthy, kind of skinny, everybody's telling you what you can't do and what you won't ever do and what you won't ever be a part of. So I had heard more naysayers than anybody telling me that I was going to make it. You know, I had a chance. I was a late bloomer. I grew late, you know, the summer after I graduated from high school, I grew 7 inches. So I wasn't a touted high school player coming out of school. So my confidence was basically just street born. It was, you know, whoever I could defeat on the playground, which in D.C. and the Maryland area and Virginia with DMV, it was, you know, a lot of great games, a lot of pros and a lot of people who could play. So that was pretty much where you build up your reputation. So that's what I had. That's the only thing I had. So to have Doc giving me that boost of confidence, you know, getting ready to go into playing my final 2 years of Division I basketball, Georgetown, that was huge.
Jerome, let me update everyone. And then I have someone I want to bring on the line for you, if you don't mind. I got a guy that works with Ricky and myself occasionally. He's been a reporter in the California area. He knows the history of the game. I'm going to just update everyone, and then I'm going to bring him back in if that's okay with you. Do you mind if I do that?
No, absolutely.
All right, I want to welcome everybody and thank you everybody for tuning in to Derek Gervin's As Good As It Gets podcast. Fantastic day. Fantastic Thursday. We have Jerome Junkyard Dog Williams on here from Georgetown Hoyle fame, Detroit Pistons fame, a 9-year NBA veteran. And I want to thank Jerome for taking time to come out of this show, on the show. I'm going to try to get Ricky to do me a favor, and I'm going to ask Jerome. The show is usually an hour. If Jerome doesn't mind, I'm going to try to extend it 5 to 10 minutes. Is that okay, Jerome? Because I have a couple of questions, and I'm sure some people would like to ask you a question or two if you don't mind.
Hey, sure.
All right, Ricky, bring Mr. Mike on, please, sir.
Mike, you on the air. Mike's on the air.
Mike, how
you
doing?
Hey, Derek, I got to apologize. I got caught up in doing some domestic stuff. I had to wash and all that kind of stuff. And I said, oh, man, it's already 10:30. So, you know, I'm out here on the West Coast and it's still morning. So, you know how they go.
Wait, you watching while we got the Junkyard Dog on the line, man?
Hey, I got caught up, man. All right. Hey, JYD, how did you get that nickname? And then what was it like playing at the historic Georgetown University?
Oh, man, which one? Well, first I'll go with the Georgetown, then I'll get back to the nickname.
All right.
So I was actually born in 1973 at Georgetown University Hospital. That's
okay.
How far back I went back with the homies. I get to Georgetown, and that's like a lifelong dream. And it was almost like something that I didn't even ever think was going to happen, because when I got there, I was already almost 21 years old, because I had been pretty much, paying my way through school, and I had gotten my first associate's degree from a local junior college called Montgomery College.
Okay.
So Georgetown was just, that was the pinnacle, you know, just growing up, watching Patrick Ewing, Lonzo Morton, Dikembe Mutombo, rooting for Georgetown all the time. You know, you either got to be like a Georgetown fan or a Maryland University fan. I was a Georgetown fan. So that was huge, man. I really enjoyed going to school there. You know, it's a unique place, because in the land of basketball, to win NCAA championships and never pay athletes is unheard of in the whole NCAA. I'm going to throw that out there on your show, because I know a lot of listeners are like, man, I never thought of it that way. Yes, you got to think of it, because certain schools, they become what they are, and, you know, because of the money that's invested in getting the top-tier players. Top-tier players, as the years roll on, are focused more on the quick fix, which is how many dollars can I get going out the gate and how fast I can get to some dollars in the NBA. So that doesn't bode well from a school that was built on 4 years of education, graduating rate of over 98% by Coach John Thompson, and not paying anybody. Handlers, parents, players. Right? Okay. So let's then go and skip over to how I got my nickname. My nickname came, there's a story too. Because I grew up watching the Bulls, like I talked about, and one of the players that I used to see play a lot was Rick Mahorn. And he played for the Bulls before he started assisting. So one thing I liked about Rick was that he was an enforcer. He used to play tough, what, you know, made us feel like, you know, we had a tough team in D.C. He used to play with Jeff Rulin. You know, him and Jeff, they was like, you know, the Blues brothers. So drafted to the Pistons. Grant Hill is the up and coming heir apparent to Michael Jordan. And we had Joe Dumars throwback. He used to guard Michael Jordan, and Rick Mahorn, right? Rick Mahorn was on the team. So first day of practice, I come to practice. Practice is at 10 o'clock. I get there 9:30, right? Get in the door. Rick Mahorn says, "Hey, Rook, I need to see you in my office." He called me over, and he's like, "Hey, man, you're late. Don't show up to the practice late again tomorrow." "Isn't practice at 10 o'clock? He said, "Yeah, practice at 10, but you're late." So I was like, "All right." The next day, I show up at like 9, right, hour before.
Late.
Late. I'm late for practice, right? The next day, I show up at 8:30, hour and a half, late. I'm like, "Man, I'm late." All right, so I was like, "All right, tomorrow I'm going to show up 2 hours before practice." Get 2 hours before practice. Late. So I said, "Okay." So by the fourth day, I show up 3.5 hours before practice. Nobody's there. Equipment manager got to let me in. No cars in the parking lot. I was like, I'm not late today, daggone. So I get there and I'm working out, shooting. Rick comes in like 2 hours, 45 minutes or so. Comes in, sees me in there working. He starts clapping. He said, "You're on time, Rook. Finally, you're finally on time." He said, "If you show up like this every day, you're going to have a long career." So from that day on, that's when I showed up like that every day to practice. Came into work, came in ready to go. Time the vets got in there, I didn't fully practice 2-3 times. So it comes down to, you know, preseason, we start playing. And we're getting preseason minutes or whatever. I don't get any minutes. Finally, like fourth quarter, Doug Collins is like, you know, because the veterans are like, "Yo, put the Rook in, you know, let him get some burn. Let's put the Rook in." So he says, "All right, Rook, get in there." He throws me in the game. Within the first 3 minutes, I had 7 points, 5 rebounds, and 3 steals. So they start barking from the bench, and they said, when I got in the game, they unleashed the dog. And they called me Junkyard Dog from that. They gave me that nickname.
That'd be great. All right,
Rick Mahorn.
Hey, Mike, I'm Ricky. I got to ask this because I have to. We talked about Dr. J, Mike, before you came on. I'm sure you heard. But I have to transition back to Georgetown for a second. I've been a big fan of this game all my life. All right, and usually the game, as you know, when we were younger, the game was more of a big man's game. And if you had the guards, they were like an Oscar Robertson size or whatever. And then all of a sudden the game changes. They bring in the tiny Archibalds and the smaller guys, the Calvin Murphys. Now I'm on Georgetown. I want you to tell me what it was like to be with a guy that has become a trendsetter in this world and something that never changed. He pretty much changed the dress code in the NBA. What was it like being a teammate with a young Allen Iverson?
You know, it was very eye-opening because, like you said, you know, when you never played with somebody that small with that of determination, grit, and basically skill and talent, it's just phenomenal. You know, he could get to places that nobody could get to on the court. He was athletic, could jump out the gym. His jump shot was definitely the best on the team. And he had the quickest first step, so he could, you know, get by anybody on the planet. Playing with a guy like that, you really appreciate it later on, because while you're there, you're still trying to figure out how he's doing this while you're trying to still do your own thing, you know. But the, some of the things that he would do, you'd be caught, you know, kind of catch yourself watching like you were watching Michael Jordan, because you're like, man, how did he just did he just do that? And you'd be kind of like trying to rewind that in your head, like, hold on, man, he just crossed this guy up and then dunked on the 7-footer while weaving in traffic. Like, hold on, who does that? And you could only think of like people like Mike. Like, literally, like, you couldn't even, like, put that in, like, you know, your normal box of, oh, yeah, that reminds me of, right? And that's what it was like on Iverson. It was crazy because, and you know, the neighborhood he came from, the things that he went through, it was amazing to me the amount of, you know, basically just focus that he was able to attain while still keeping his you know, his ways, like his the way he wanted to do it. He'd tell us, when I get to the league, I'm going to cross up Michael Jordan. And we were like, man, he stops, you know, I know I haven't seen you smoke, but you're smoking. You're not going to cross Michael Jordan when you get to the league. And we used to go back and forth. And by golly, you know, everybody knows the famous crossover. But he'd speak those kinds of things into existence. I'm a dunk on this dude. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And we just shake our heads. But at Georgetown, we had a unique opportunity to play against Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, Dikembe during the summers before we even became pro. So that was our first levels of, you know, being able to try out what we could do on them. So we could do it on them, then we had a good chance. So he would do some things, and I'd be like, man, he just did that to Patrick Ewing. He just did that to Zim, defensive player of the year. So I just, so from there, I was like, man, this dude, he definitely going to be an NBA player.
That's some great school training right there, man. Being able to work out against those guys. Hey,
right.
Hey, Drew,
right.
Here in Detroit, you came in, the bad boys had gotten old. I think Rick was really the only guy left, and Dennis was gone. I really thought you played well, and you filled a lot of the roles that Dennis did, but I don't think you were really appreciated because you guys weren't winning to the level that they did. And, of course, you know, Dennis was Dennis. I really thought you underappreciated here in Detroit. And I also want you to talk about Dennis's impact on the Bulls. Of course, they had Michael, they had Scottie, but I really thought, and you had to deal with them, I really thought what Dennis was bringing them was really, really important to their success.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the one thing about, you know, when I got drafted at Pistons, I was a late-round pick. They really didn't expect to be able to get that kind of talent that late in the draft. I was in that 96 draft where, you know, one of, arguably the best draft in NBA history in terms of the talent, all-stars, MVPs, Hall of Famers that came out of one draft. And so me going to the Pistons, really, they weren't really, you know, I guess, prepared for, really. And so I didn't get a lot of the minutes that I probably should have gotten just from that main fact. Couple that with we had Grant Hill as a rising star, Joe Dumars transitioning into retirement, but still getting the respect of a, you know, of their finals MVP. By being played, by getting the minutes, and then from there, them managing the salary cap and how do you get a big man? Because that at that time we had the three centers, Alonzo Mourning, Dikembe Mutombo, and Patrick Ewing, all in the East. So, not to mention Michael Jordan. So you're talking about three Hall of Fame centers who are defensive players of the year, and their team's leading scorer, shot blocker, rebounders. coupled with the fact that we don't have a big.
Yeah.
You know, so
Mike,
small
let me
ball
ask you
hadn't come into play yet. Yeah, but, you know, because when you say I was underappreciated, that really was where it was at the time and the era that I played in. But, like, you to your point, Dennis Rodman was able to play alongside Michael Jordan, which the triangle offense was a moving, flowing offense built for people with speed, athleticism, being able to move and having a dominant go-to scorer in Michael Jordan. So that really is, you know, when I look at the two teams and the era that they were able to win at, they were basically winning without a center. So they were doing what a lot of teams who didn't have those top-tier centers were trying to do, but they didn't have Michael Jordan. So we always made the playoffs, and we always came up short.
Jerome, I have a quick question for you while you're on that Spurs thing. A lot of people, I don't think, know how you ended up in Detroit. If I'm correct, weren't the 26th pick was originally for the Spurs. So you had
That's
an
right.
opportunity to be down here, right? And then they made the trade, and sent you went end up going there as part of the package, and Rodman came to San Antonio. Did you ever think about what it might have been like to play in San Antonio under Greg Popovich?
You know what? I've thought about that, you know, and it was like, you know, like you said, the trade with Dennis Rodman that gave him that pick in the draft, drafted me. So it was interesting because, yeah, a lot of things, your NBA journey can go a lot of different directions, and San Antonio would have been a good direction for any player to have that.
I have to ask the other part because I know when I think back, it wasn't Pop. That year, 96, and I don't have to look at anything. That's the year John Lucas was coach, I believe.
Okay.
And
John Lucas
you come in here,
was my
yeah,
coach.
Yeah, John Lucas was the coach, David Robinson. But if you – I thought about that when I looked at your history. I was like, wow, you had a chance to end up in San Antonio which ended up being a five-time champion, but I don't think you kind of would regret playing in Detroit. I have to ask you why we're on the subject, because I played against Joe Dumars in college. What was it like when you got to Detroit? Did you ever have any conversations with Joe? Because I looked at Joe as kind of like Dr. J, David Robinson, guys that walk the walk and talk the talk. They never had any issues. Similar to LeBron today. What was it like at that time dealing with Joe Dumars?
All right, I'll give you my Joe Dumars story. So I'm a rookie, and Joe, you know, I used to, you know, go get to practice early, stay late, right? So after one of the practices, Joe was like, Rook, rebound the ball for me. No problem, Joe. Let me get over here and get the rebound, right? So I had rebounded for a lot of different players and, you know, veterans, whatever they ever asked me, so it wasn't nothing new. This time it was Joe. I stand underneath the basket. I'm like, this isn't that much work. Joe was hitting all the shots, right? So Joe was hitting all three-pointers. He said, I'm just going to go around the three-point line. No problem, Joe. I'm passing them, making sure my passes are crisp, getting it right back out to him, right? So Joe hits five shots in a row. Then he says one, then hits two shots, then he says two, then he hits, you know, three more shots, then he says three. I'm like, wow, this is weird. Yeah, you know, I don't understand his counting, right? But I don't say nothing. I'm a rook. I'm like, let me just keep. So this got all the way up to 30 shots, right? And that he had counted. Right? Now, I've counted at least 100, but he's counting 30. So at 35, I catch one of the balls that comes through, and he's maybe missed like three or four total, right? And and I catch the ball, and I said, Joe, how many we shooting today, right? In mid throw. So as I ask, I throw the ball. He catches it, makes another one. He said, "Oh, I'm just making 100." I said, "Making 100." And I said, Joe, you've already made 100 shots. He said, "Rook, man, I only count the ones that don't hit the rim."
Well, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Man,
go.
Listen.
True talk.
Hey, listen, man. When he said that, I had a whole new respect, a perspective.
Yeah.
My whole perspective has shifted. It was like I had stepped into the Twilight Zone. I'm like, what did this Negro just say? He said, "He don't even count." This man that made 23s in a row, but because 19 of them hit the rim when they went in, they don't count. I was like, from that moment on, I knew I never wanted to be a number two guard in the league. I was like, I'll never want to be a shooter in this league. I was like, I can be a scorer. I can be a lot of things. But this man is shooting rainbow threes, and this is when the three-point line was, like, you know, at its furthest point. So it wasn't, you know, they moved it in. It was a couple years later. We're at the, you know, the 30-foot line.
Jerome,
he out here just walking around and training them. And I'm like, this dude has not missed. And I'm like, all right. So I was like, okay. It just gave me a whole different perspective. And, you know, also made me a better rebounder because I had watched this shot. I studied this shot. I was able to, you know, basically find my own little niche of, look, you know, shooting percentages are important. Like, I was career over 50%, you know, shooter from the field because I was like, look, man, these dudes are professionals. We're all professionals. If you're going to put that ball up, there should be a high percentage of it going in. And that was my mentality just from rebounding from a guy like Joe Dumars. So if he's that detail oriented in practice in the game, what do you think? You get mad at Joe for not shooting. Then I go and I'm playing with guys like Dell Curry, you know, other famous shooters, Allen Houston, like another good shooter I can remember. Like, these dudes, man, they on a whole nother level. They're shot release.
Jamal Crawford. Don't leave out Jamal.
Jamal Crawford. Yeah. Played with JC. So it's like, you know, these guys are different. JC was more of the young version because, you know, JC never practiced his shot.
Wow.
What?
Jamal never came in. Yep. Jamal never came in and took shots before practice or after practice. He would shoot all his practice shots during practice. And he didn't start to practice shooting. And you can look it up. He didn't start practice shooting after his 10th year in the league.
Wow.
Where he said, dang, I mean, he said, if I would have known this, what I know now. Now, people encourage him to shoot, of course. Like, you ain't going to take no shots, man. Nah, I get mine up during the game. You know, that was just him. But he realized that improved his mechanics, and he was able to have a longer career because of, you know, his percentages going up and different things. Yeah.
Hey, Mike Robertson got a question for you.
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, first of all, Derek, wasn't Bob Hill the coach by then?
He might have been. 96, I think he did come in during that season.
Yeah, because remember Pop was GM and fired him and hired himself right in time for Tim Duncan.
Yeah.
But that's
yeah.
another story. All right. And also, JYD, I think the class 84 probably think that their draft was better too.
They think it is. But we're still pulling out Hall of Famer. They already got all theirs.
Okay, all right. All right, well, let's go back to the draft, because that draft was interesting because, of course, you know, Kobe coming out of high school, and then, of course, Allen was number one pick. But the interesting one was, I was at the time I was covering the Milwaukee Bucks, so they drafted Marbury, but he got traded right away to Minnesota for Ray Allen. So when you saw that, what did you think of that whole scenario, and then just that whole first year of that draft?
Well, that was kind of shocking, trading in the first, couple of picks in the draft. Him going to Minnesota, and of course Ray going to Milwaukee. That was definitely interesting. Opened up my eyes a little bit. I think that, when you're a rookie, man, everything is just so new. You're learning things at a rapid pace. You're trying to understand this new environment, and it's totally different than what you've seen in the past. And a lot of times that comes with, time, right? It comes with experience. And that's pretty much how I viewed that. I think that was a lot of things. I mean, when you see Charlotte, does the trade with Lottie Divac for the Lakers and get Kobe Bryant. And Kobe was an unknown, right? And the Lakers were just foaming at the mouth, hoping that he would drop, because New Jersey had the pick that they took Kerry Kittles, but they were very high on Kobe. But they didn't think that Kobe's workout was real. They were like, kid must have just had an unbelievable workout. But the pundits were saying, man, what if he didn't just have a, good workout? What if this is real? So he almost became a New Jersey Net. Yeah. And then you look at Steve Nash going 15, right?
Yep.
Steve Nash goes 15. Jermaine O'Neal goes 19. I mean, these are all-stars, MVPs, not even in the lottery.
That's true.
Turning in like Malik Rose and Othello Harrington going in the second round. Moochie Norris, second round. Ben Wallace didn't even get drafted. He had to get picked up, mid-season by Washington. That's a Hall of Famer. We got it. It's a serious draft, man. You can't, I think 84 needs just accept being second.
Jerome, you talked about
that. Hey, look, a strong second is still what it is. I mean, they got some of the best players in the game, but so did we.
We got a top three scorer. Jerome, you played with Othello Harrington at Georgetown, if I'm correct, right?
That's correct.
Now, I got to ask you, you look at the draft from that time. Mike brings up the draft from 96. And then you look at today, what's going on in today's game. Like right now, I know with the pandemic going on, we don't know what's happening with the draft. I know LaMelo Ball is rated high, Anthony Edwards and a few other guys. What do you think about how the draft has changed over the last 20 years? Is this something that's good for people, that's better than it used to be, or is this something that still needs to be fixed a little more?
Well, I think that, for the most part, the draft now is different just because the dynamics have changed so much in terms of our whole social engagement. Social media has, infiltrated a lot of the popularity that's involved with players, and LaMelo is definitely one of them. Now, that doesn't mean that, your talent has to be, basically shopped and checked and all that, because they do still do those things and will continue to do them. But I do think that social media also plays a role in guys' name, image, and likeness, that in the past, they didn't have those kinds of things with the players of our day.
Go ahead, Mike.
All right. Yeah. Well, my question is this: so you, when you came in, expansion had kind of gotten a little bit bigger. The Canadian teams came in, and you eventually ended up in Toronto. So, what was it like going across the border playing those games, and what was the fan appeal in Vancouver and in Toronto, which is still there?
You know what? I really feel sorry for Vancouver because Vancouver had a great city, and players to this day still miss going to Vancouver. The fan base ownership obviously decided to move down to Memphis, but Vancouver was definitely a good city. Toronto was a beneficiary of that because once they moved, then they gave Toronto the entire country to be able to market to. Before Vancouver left, it was only, you know, the eastern sector of the region that they could market the Raptors to. But then the Raptors became Canada's team, and that was during my tenure there, that it was now Canada's team, and they could market all over Canada, which then allowed for our branding as players to then grow throughout the whole market and not just in the Toronto GTA. I think that that was huge because, you know, I was getting appearances in Vancouver, in Calgary, you know, in other parts of Canada that were western, you know, west from Toronto, as far as Halifax and other places. So it was good, yeah.
Huh. You there, Ricky? Hey, Jerome, before we get off the air, I wanted to kind of switch over for a minute because I know you I want you to tell me about this Otis Washington. I know you appeared in a Disney kind of movie. Tell me what it was like venturing into the acting world.
Yeah, Otis, man. Otis is a character I played for Sue Thomas, FBI. Otis was trying to get his life together, man. You know, but sometimes he just couldn't get right. He'd see a TV laying around, he just had to grab so he could take it to the pawn shop. Otis was there. In the end, you know, he always ended up helping the good guys. So that was my character for Sue Thomas, FBI. I had a lot of good opportunities like that when I was playing for the Raptors, doing those shows and doing some other movies that I got to appear in, like Full Court Miracle, a Disney movie that still plays, Harold and Kumar, Visit White Castle. Yeah, it was a lot of fun times acting, man. But one thing I can say about acting, and it's from those are some long hours between takes. You know, they get you those trailers for a reason. You got to sit there for a minute while they set things up for your you know, 30 seconds that you're going to be in the movie.
All right, Jerome, quick question. So you're from the DMV, of course, you know, a lot of accolades there. You played in Detroit, and you played in Toronto, which is one of the most respected international cities. Then you played in Chicago and New York. So are you grateful that you played in some of these major markets and not had to be in, like, Salt Lake City or something like that?
Man, I'm very grateful. I mean, you know, to play 9 years in the NBA and – you know, seven of those years you're in the playoffs, you can't complain about that career, especially in the cities that I played in. Major markets spoil you in a lot of ways because organizations are big. They've, you know, every organization except for Toronto, they had all won championships prior to me getting there. So you see the banner up there, and you're trying to duplicate or replicate it. And then, of course, Toronto just winning this past year. So those are the kinds of things that that I definitely remember playing in those major markets and really appreciating the history.
Jerome, we're going to get ready to close it down, man. I have to tell you, it's been a fantastic show. I'm hoping that I can get you back on in the future. Man, I mean, this has been fun. I haven't laughed this much in a while. And we didn't even cover half the things that I really wanted to talk to you about. So I'm going to thank you for taking time out of your day. I'm hoping I can get you back on again. And I just look forward to your future, man. I want to wish you the best on all your future endeavors and just tell you that I have a lot of respect for you, man. For me, you the junkyard dog forever, and I hold you in very high esteem, man. And I just want to thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me, man. Shout out to the dog pound and you guys for having me.
Boy, you were great, man. Thanks, Jerome.
Yeah, yep.
You
look forward
it,
to talking to you again, man. Have a great day.
Yep.
All right, you too.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Yep.
Well, people, I guess we're ready to close it down. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. The Derek Irvin's As Good As It Gets podcast. Of course, I want to thank Mr. Ricky Hampton Sr. and Mr. Michael Robertson. Without these gentlemen, we couldn't make it happen. So I appreciate you two guys, man. I just hope you guys, we can do this again soon.
Yep, yep, likewise.
Take care, everybody.
Everybody have a great night. Have a great day, Ricky.